right. Last time we had just looked at this overview of the book of Samuel, and I wanted just to show that to you. My slide wasn't too visible last time, so if you didn't get all that in your notes, maybe you might want to jot that down very quickly. But we're going to be looking at this first section, the first seven chapters of what we call 1 Samuel, focusing in on the work of Samuel, who really almost single-handedly will pull the nation from their apostasy of the Judges era and bring them back into a fulfilling of the law of Moses. So a tremendously significant character. And we want to look at chapters 1 and 2. And let me just go ahead and read the very first few verses here. Now there was a certain man from Ramathaim Zophim, from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord there. When the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters, but to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. It happened year after year, as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" All right, let's go ahead and just pause there and kind of set the stage here for what the text is talking about. Samuel's father, Elkanah, is an Ephraimite, and the events of Samuel's life will take place largely around this territory of Ephraim. And the tabernacle of God was located at Shiloh, which is in the territory of Ephraim. And in fact, you may recall from our study of the Judges that the tabernacle had been erected there at Shiloh after Joshua had led the Israelites across the Jordan River, or at least shortly thereafter. And so really most of the time during the Judges era, the tabernacle is set up at Shiloh. And so as the book of Samuel now opens up, this is where the tabernacle is. The text says that Samuel's family live at Ramah. There's the fuller name given in verse 1, Ramathaim Zophim. But then later on in the text, you have just the shorter form of the name Ramah. There were a lot of Ramas in Palestine. That word Ramah is just a Hebrew word that means height. So any hill or any, you know, higher elevation might be called Ramah, and it would kind of depend upon the actual territory. This was Ramah in the territory of Zuph, and we're not exactly sure where in Ephraim it is, so I can't point that out to you on a map. You might have a Bible map that gives a Ramah here in Ephraim, and that's a guess. But somewhere in this general area is the Ramah that the text is talking about, and that's Samuel's home city, or the city of his father and his mother. Now let's just look at and talk a little bit about the principal characters here in Samuel's family. First of all, Elkanah is referred to here as an Ephraimite. Now what's kind of curious is that over in 1 Chronicles chapter 6, he's listed in the genealogy of the Levites. So what would you maybe suspect from that? How might you harmonize what 1 Chronicles 6 is saying when it lists him as a Levite, and yet here the text in 1 Samuel 1, verse 1, refers to him as an Ephraimite? I'm sorry, Pat? Okay, that's probably the case. What Pat is suggesting is that we're talking about one of the Levites who are living in the territory of Ephraim, and perhaps that's what's being referred to here, so that he's an Ephraimite as far as where he lives, but actually as far as his genealogy, he's in the genealogy of the Levites. But one thing I do want to make clear about all of this, even though the father of Samuel is a Levite, and he's in that Levitical lineage, is he in the lineage of the priesthood through Aaron? And the answer is no, no. And we're going to talk about that further when we look at Samuel and some of the priestly functions that Samuel performs. But I just want everyone to see that distinction as we begin. All right, now what's a little bit unusual about this particular man? His family circumstance. He has two wives. Okay, a little unusual or maybe daring, depending on which word you want to use. Wish I hadn't said that. Okay. The text says that he had two wives, Peninnah and Hannah. And I've made the point before, when you have multiple wives in the ancient culture, what is that really a sign of? Wealth. So this is a man of some means, okay? And so his first wife, Peninnah, or at least the one that I have listed here on the chart, she bore him many children. And of course, the problem that Hannah has is that, in fact, what's the phrase that the text uses about her inability to bear children? How's it worded? Who closed her womb? The Lord had closed her womb. Okay. So the Lord had closed her womb. She was unable to have children. And as a result of this, what was the relationship like between these two women? Wasn't real good, was it? In fact, your version may even use the English word rival to talk about them. And, of course, what the text talks about is that Peninnah, gloated in the fact that she was able to bear children to Elkanah, but Hannah was not able to do so. And, of course, that was a particular shame, especially in that society. It was a shame. I mean, that was one of the major functions of a woman. And that's what a woman would have said. Was her major function was to give this offspring to her husband. To provide this fertile field that his offspring might grow. That's how the womb of a wife was viewed. And that's the concept here. And so the text says the Lord had closed Hannah's womb. And yet what's stated about Elkanah's view of Hannah? He really loved her more than Peninnah. And even that, though that, of course, is one of the problems when you have polygamous marriages, but that was something that was very common. Multiple wives is going to be some favored wife. Well, Hannah was his favored wife, but her womb was barren. And the Lord had closed her womb. She wasn't able to have children. So this is a very significant thing that is going on, and then the animosity that is going on between these two women. Now, right off the bat, does this story, as it's unfolding, does it remind you of anything? Okay, somebody elaborate on all of that. What about Abraham? You just can't help but read this and not see the parallels between Sarah and Hagar and the problems that resulted there. Any other parallel that comes to mind? All right, Rachel and Leah. Why in the world would Mickey, of all people, have thought of that parallel? I can't imagine why. But I mean, that's just exactly right. And what you see as you go back to the book of Genesis, a book that is all about God's promises, and starting in Genesis 3, verse 15, God's promise of ultimate blessing upon man would come through what means? Genesis 3:15, it would be the seed of woman. The seed of woman. Don't just view that passage in Genesis 3 as, oh, well, that's just talking about the future coming of Christ. You have to see that in light of the entire Old Testament picture. And what you see throughout Genesis is that God's blessing is through women. And what accentuates the fact that God is overturning the problem of sin and all of its ramifications, God is doing that through the seed of woman. What accentuates that is that these matriarchs in the book of Genesis at first are not able to become matriarchs at all. Their wombs are closed. Except for the power of God that finally enables them to bear children. And that's what you see with Sarah. And that's what you see with Rachel. And now this is what you see happening with Hannah. And so I want to make sure everybody sees this idea that what we're reading about here in 1 Samuel is events that have happened before, at least similar events have happened before, in how God is dealing with things. And so this child that Hannah is going to finally bear is absolutely a significant child. And we'll see as we go on further the further implications of Samuel and his work. All right, question or comment about any of that up to this point? All right, so let's go ahead a little bit further then in the text. And one thing that I did mention before is that the text says in verse 3 that Elkanah every year would go up to the house of the Lord at Shiloh to offer sacrifices. Now that might be referring to one of these pilgrimage feasts that everybody would go up for. But I really kind of think that it's talking about his practice as an individual to go up to Shiloh and offer sacrifices to the Lord as either a free will offering or what might be another occasion when an Israelite might make a trek to the sanctuary of God to offer up a personal sacrifice. When he was fulfilling what? A vow. Which may have some significance to what we're going to ultimately see with Samuel and Hannah. But every year, this is what he would do. And every year, the family would make that trek to the sanctuary of God. And this, of course, is when Hannah would receive that double portion from her husband, and yet she's so upset by the treatment of her rival wife and her inability to bear children that she can't even eat. And she's crying about all of this, and Elkanah is saying, am I not better to you than 10 sons? I'm providing you with everything I have, even more than what you need. You know, trying to do what we men often try to do to ration, you know, look at this rationally, you know, but of course that, you know, we miss it. She's reacting, of course, in a very appropriate way in reference to how she feels and her emotions and her sadness about all of this. But he's doing the best he can to console her. All right, but come down now to verse 9. Then Hannah rose after eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She, greatly distressed, prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. She made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head. Now that's really a significant statement, and I want to come back to that in just a moment, but keep on reading. Now it came about as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli was watching her mouth. As for Hannah, she was speaking in her heart, only her lips were moving, but her voice was not heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Then Eli said to her, "How long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine from you." But Hannah replied, "No, my Lord, I am a woman oppressed in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord." That's a significant statement. Did you pick up on that? We'll come back to that. "Do not consider your maidservant as a worthless woman, for I have spoken until now out of my great concern and provocation." Then Eli answered and said, "Go in peace, and may the God of Israel grant your petition that you have asked of him." She said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. All right, let's talk about this. Hannah's vow. Okay. Hannah's vow. Before we get to that, she's making this vow, praying to God, and what is striking as far as Eli is concerned? What strikes him as he watches this woman? Jeff.
Just the praying with the making the sounds. It seems like she should be making the sounds, but she's not.
Yeah, why was that something that would have been surprising to Eli? See, we are so part of our modern culture. This is totally, we don't even think like this. But as soon as you hear me say it, it'll make perfect sense to you. Yeah, the people in that culture never prayed silently. You know, we pray silently all the time. That's what we do in private. That's something that we do as an act of private worship. Pray silently. Ancient cultures, they did not pray silently. In fact, you had to make yourself do that, and you would never make yourself do that. Why is it that we pray silently? Where did we get that? Yeah, but what would have even made us come up with it? I mean, we pray silently and don't even move our lips, which just shows how used we are to the idea of praying silently. Where did we learn that?
Jesus.
No, culturally, where did we learn that? That's how we teach our kids to read, silently. The natural way to read is to read out loud. And that's why ancient cultures always read out loud. Even if you were alone, you'd read out loud. If you were alone, you'd pray out loud. I mean, this concept of praying and reading silently is a modern Western culture thing. And in fact, if you think about it, it isn't natural. And what proves it that it's not natural? What do we as parents do? We force our kids to read silently. In fact, we even get upset with them if they're making any noise at all when they And we even criticize little Johnny if his lips are moving. You know? I mean, we are really fanatical about this as a culture. I'm just saying that's really odd. But that's the way it is in our culture. But in the ancient culture, you would read out loud. Now, maybe if you were trying to be a little quieter or something, you might tone down the volume. But that was really odd. And you would pray out loud. And so the idea of praying with absolute silence is just really a strange thing. And so he is observing her, and everybody comes up to the sanctuary, and they're all praying out loud. Have you ever seen a documentary about Jews at the Wailing Wall? It's pretty noisy. That's why. Now they're saying private prayers, but everybody's murmuring the prayer out loud. Well, that's what's going on. But Hannah is not praying her prayer out loud in a normal volume. What if that were the case? Then Eli wouldn't even have noticed her. But what you can't hear what she's saying, and her lips are moving, but she's very very quiet in that. And so, of all things, he concludes, she's got to be drunk. Only a drunk person would be doing that. Now, what's ironic about that being what he would think she was doing, that she was really drunk? What's so ironic about that? Yeah. I mean, of all things, he accuses her. Just, you know, doesn't ask her if she's drunk. I mean, there's no question in his mind. She is drunk, you know. And, you know, how dare you do that here at the sanctuary of God? Come here drunk. Not only is she not drunk, but the ironic thing is she's actually praying to God. Okay, so it's not the spirit of wine in her by any means. She's praying to God's spirit. And of all things, her prayer is a vow saying that her son, if God gives her a son, will totally abstain from wine, because that's all part of what a Nazarite vow is. So that's kind of ironic. Absolutely. I mean, it's very obvious once Eli begins to converse with her, she's not drunk at all. I mean, she's coherent, and she has a purpose to what she is doing. All right, so it's a really interesting event that is taking place here. Okay, what exactly is her vow? Yeah, Jerry? I wouldn't think so. Why would the apostles want to be taught to pray? Well, I think when they ask that, Jerry, they're not, it isn't that they've never prayed before, but I think they're wanting to find out how to pray more effectively. What does God want in our prayers? What's the content of our prayers? You know, that I think that's what they're really asking, and that's what Jesus shows them. I don't know that it would have been strange for a woman to have been praying. Women could worship there at the sanctuary too. All right, so what exactly is her vow? We need to really talk about this. Make sure we all see this clearly. All right, if God gives her a son, she will give him up for the Lord's service. Now, is this kind of request of God wherein, you know, you are saying, Lord, if you'll do this, then I'll do that. Is that something that was inappropriate in the Mosaic system? I mean, it seems inappropriate to us sometimes in our sensibility. I've had people, you know, talk about these votive prayers, which is what this is. Lord, if you'll do this, then I'll do this. You know, it almost sounds like a quid pro quo, you know. But this is not in reference to something about what God has commanded. She isn't making a deal with God about, well, I'll obey you if you'll do something for me. That's not the issue. But she is saying, Lord, I desperately want a child. And the law of Moses allowed this, that you could make a votive prayer to God and state a condition upon which you would do something for God. A voluntary thing that you weren't commanded to do by God, but you just voluntarily were doing it of your own free will. And so she says, if God will give her a son, then she will give him up for the Lord's service. And We need to appreciate exactly what she's talking about. I want everyone to turn real quickly back to Exodus chapter 13. I mentioned this a little bit when we were talking about Samson, but I didn't actually go back and just look at these verses. And I'm not going to take time to look at all these verses that we could analyze in Exodus 13. But look at Exodus 13, verse 1. This is on the occasion of the Israelites leaving Egypt. This is the night that they're going to be leaving Egypt. It's the night of the Passover. And so God's getting instructions about all of that. And so in Exodus chapter 13, verse 1, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast. It belongs to me." Okay. Does everybody realize that's the principle of childbirth in the Law of Moses system? Whether you're talking about your flocks or whether you're talking about your own family, the firstborn child, the firstborn offspring, it's God. It belongs to God. And what's the principle that is underlying that, by the way? First fruits, or God gets the first and best of everything. And God always comes first, because He's the one that gives you those crops and gives you those offspring to begin with. So you always honor God. And that's what He's saying here. So sanctify every firstborn offspring. Okay, now skip down to verse 11. "Now when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, as He swore to you and to your fathers, and gives it to you, you shall devote to the Lord the first offspring of every womb and the first offspring of every beast that you own. The males belong to the Lord. But every first offspring of a donkey," and then it goes on and talks about some exceptions here and there, like what you do in this certain circumstance. Basically, just to kind of say it in a very concise way, the firstborn offspring of your animals were sacrificed to God. And the firstborn of your children was sacrificed to God in the sense of belonging to God. And of course, where is God in the Mosaic system? Where does He dwell among the people? At the tabernacle. Okay? Okay, but as you go on down in this chapter, and I won't take time to read all of it, what you see is that the normal practice, though, that the Law of Moses set up was that the parents would buy their firstborn child back from God. And what's the term that's used in the Bible for that? When you buy it back from God, you are redeeming it. Okay. So that's the background of all of this that she is vowing. Now you need to appreciate this. Though the law is saying that the firstborn belongs to God, I mean, virtually every time an Israelite was expected, and in fact did, redeem their firstborn child. You didn't have your firstborn child live at the sanctuary, but it belonged to God. That's what this law said, but God said, you're to buy him back. You're to redeem him. And so that was the concept. All right? So with that in mind, does everyone appreciate what she's saying? Lord, if you will remember me and open my womb that you have closed, if you'll remember me and give me a son, I will not redeem him. He will stay sanctified to you. And she even specifies it, because the implication of what she's saying is he's going to be a Nazarite for life, wholly dedicated to God for life, because she's not going to redeem him back. Does everyone appreciate that and see what's going on here? Okay. All right. Remember, we've talked about this whole concept of the Nazarite vow. And remember, it's this concept of setting apart and making holy and then distinguishing that individual. Someone who's a Nazarite or a Nazir is set apart and holy in a very special way. Now, what's really crucial, I think, to understand all of this is it is the holiness of someone under a Nazarite vow is that person set apart and holy as part of the ordinary Mosaic institution of the priesthood and all of that? No. In fact, someone under a Nazarite vow, it's kind of their own individual concept of holiness there. They're not part of a Levitical priesthood, and that's why they're holy. They're holy because they're under this Nazarite vow. And it's something that applies just to them. It's not something that you pass on to your children, you know, like say the priesthood was passed on to your descendants. That's not the concept here. And ordinarily, this Nazarite vow, as we've already talked about with Samson, is a temporary thing, just for a set period of time. But what you see here with Samson, and now what Hannah is saying about Samuel, is he will be a Nazarite for life. And so the restrictions of someone who's dedicated to God under a Nazarite vow, okay, for life, then this is what will be the case with Samuel, if the Lord gives him that son, or gives her that son. No wine or grape products. No contact with a dead body, avoiding all forms of uncleanness. And the sign of a Nazarite, the sign that one was under a Nazarite vow, is that one's hair would not be cut for the entirety of the time he was under that vow. And especially if it was a long vow period, and certainly in this case, a lifelong vow period, you'd wrap your hair up and, you know, bind it, but you would not cut it, ever. And so this is what Hannah is saying. And this is so significant. Why was Samson under a Nazarite vow for life? Did his mother come up with that idea? The Lord commanded that of her. Remember, the Lord appeared to her, or the angel appeared to Samson's mother? And then again to both she and his father. Okay, but now with Hannah, this is something that she's doing on her own. And she's promising that he will be a Nazarite for life. Why did God create lifelong Nazarites like Samson and Samuel? I asked you this question before. Why did God have to create lifelong Nazarites like Samson and Samuel?
We're going to learn that the priesthood was corrupt.
Okay. And in fact, it seems to me that really is the point of this. Remember what I just said, that the whole idea of a Nazarite is that's a kind of special holiness, in a sense, separate and apart from the holiness of the Levitical institution itself. And what you see here during the Judges era is how corrupt the nation has become, how spiritually decadent they have become, and the institution, the Mosaic system, the Levitical priesthood is very corrupt. In fact, we even will see that with Eli, the high priest, and his sons. Very corrupt. So I think that the point here is that God is virtually, not totally, but virtually having to step outside the Mosaic system, the institution as it normally would establish holiness, and create a special kind of holy individual to perform these tasks, because it was God's way of sending a message that the people themselves and this Mosaic system is just corrupt and unholy. It's a powerful way to send that message. And of course, as we saw with Samson, did Samson live up to his Nazarite vow of holiness? No, again and again he would violate it. But look at what you see with Samuel as we keep going in the text. He's going to be everything Samson should have been when it comes to the Nazarite vow. Okay? All right, comments or questions? Jeff?
Because the farm teams weren't producing, he had to go to free.
Yes, that's There's another passage that makes that very point. I'm sure. No, that's a good analogy. Yeah, yeah. Nancy?
Could only firstborn children be taken after
death? No. No. Number six said that anyone could become a Nazarite by choosing to place himself under a vow for that set period of time. But of course, this with Samson and Samuel is tremendously novel, that you've got a lifelong Nazarite vow. Okay. Yeah, Tom. Yeah, when you look at Acts 21, Paul, it talks about Paul. As a Jew, as Jews commonly would do, would for a set period of time, put himself under a Nazarite vow. Sure. Well, that to me is a good point to show that he's talking about a cultural truth that for there in Corinth, not the way it would necessarily be in a Jewish society. But that's another discussion. All right, other comments about this with a Nazarite vow? All right, well, let's keep going into the text here. All right, look at verse 19. Then they arose early in the morning and worshipped before the Lord and returned to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah had relations with Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. That's a great phrase. And the Lord remembered. It came about in due time that Hannah had conceived, and she gave birth to a son. And she named him Samuel, saying, "Because I have asked him of the Lord." There's a word play. There's a pun that she's making off of the name. The word Shamuel, or the name Shamuel, that's how you say it in Hebrew, literally means something like name of God. Name that is associated with God in some way. And when someone names something, who has the right to name something? The owner, right? That's why parents name their children. Well, she's making a play off of that, and the other Hebrew word for, or there's another Hebrew word for ask, because she had asked for the Lord to give her this. And the Hebrew word for ask is sha'al. And so she's making a play off of that, because in Hebrew, the name Shamuel, it sounds similar and looks similar in written form to the concept of to ask for something. And so she's making a playoff of that, and I'm going to call him Samuel because I have asked him of the Lord, for the Lord to give me something that belongs to him. And so then when you look at verses 21 and following, the text says that Elkanah went up with all his household to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow, and he asked his wife to then go up with him, with the child. And what does she say? Why is she not going to go up on this occasion? Hasn't weaned him yet. Okay, in that culture, you'd wean your child maybe two or three years. Kids wean. Aren't you glad you live in our culture? But that was the case. And let me just make this comment. In the Mosaic law, who could overturn a vow that a wife would make? Well, a father, but a married woman, who could overturn a married woman's vow? Husband. There's an underlying point here. Elkanah had every right, according to the law of Moses, to cancel her vow. He's giving up one of his sons. And she did this apparently all on her own. But I think it shows what kind of man he is. And he allows her to honor her vow and to keep her vow. Okay? So, keep going. And throughout the rest of chapter 1, she then finally comes after the child is weaned and brings herself before Eli and explains who this child is. And so verse 28, "So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord." Okay. Now, I want to take just a few minutes. We have maybe about 5 minutes left, I think. Maybe 1 minute. Look at the prayer of Hannah. It's a beautiful prayer. "My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation." Let me just pause here and kind of explain some things. What's she talking about in this prayer or this song when she talks about my horn is exalted? What's that referred to? What's that imagery? Well, in the a ram's horn or the horn of an is a sign of strength. So when that horn is exalted, it's a sign of victory and strength. And all of her prayer, the entire prayer, is talking about how God allows someone who is the weak one, the one on the low rung of the ladder, the one who's oppressed, to actually overcome and be at the top. Is that not what was true of her? It's exactly what this is about. Now, it's a very general kind of prayer and song, but it's a powerful, powerful message. Verse 2, "There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one like you, nor is there any rock like our God." Verse 4, let me just skip down. "The bows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry cease to hunger. Even the barren gives birth to seven." That's like a perfect number. "But she who has many children languishes. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low. He also exalts. He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles to inherit a seat of honor." I mean, this is a marvelous, marvelous prayer talking about how God just turns the tables and takes someone who's in a lowly estate and elevates them to a high, high position. Who in the New Testament utters words that obviously are drawn from Hannah's prayer? Mary. When Mary gives her song, her prayer of exaltation after the angel Gabriel comes to her.
Her response to the angel is the same as Hannah's response to Eli.
There are all these parallels there. Okay? And isn't it interesting? What's the irony of this song, this prayer of Hannah? What did Eli, you know, when he first saw her, she's saying her vow very quietly so no one will hear, you know. But ultimately, her song of exaltation is what all the Israelites would sing. And certainly all those Israelite maidens would sing. Why do you think Mary, when she gives her song, that's what the words that come to Mary's mind? So isn't that interesting? The woman who's so demure and keeping it private, ultimately, this song of exaltation is something that everyone shouts. Okay? Thank you, folks.